In today's show, you'll hear about the remarkable efforts of many, led by Lori Adolph, a spiritual advisor who helped develop a hospice-modeled program at CMC based on training incarcerated men to care for their peers at the end of life. Also, Carson Dean joined the program while incarcerated at CMC and shares his journey from a murderous life of greed and power to one of compassion, mercy, and forgiveness. And we're going to have a discussion about all of that and the book that they wrote. And I thank you both for being here, Lori and Carson. Oh. I have so many questions for both of you. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris, for having us today.
You know, I'm going to start, Lori, with if you can just talk just a little bit about how a woman like you got involved, how many years ago? Almost 20?
Well, it was in 2001.
2001. Yeah. So 13 years ago.
Right.
Got involved in doing this program, helping start this program at California Men's Colony. And why?
Well, I must first give recognition to Dr. Denise Taylor.
Yes.
Who was very primary in even working with getting the group together, the committee together, to decide whether or not this would be appropriate to have at California Men's Colony. So we gathered, she invited me to come and be part of the planning committee, and we worked for almost a year with various committee members representing custody and administrative staff and the warden and quite a variety, and the medical staff, of course. And until we had kind of put together a model, a way that we wanted to go in creating this community standard, which is actually what San Luis Obispo was already doing. And within the prison system, we said, this is a community standard. This is a right for the men to have the opportunity when they are on their last journey, when they are faced with chronic and terminal illness, that they need the friendship, the companionship of others who will support them in this. So we started the program and began with a small group of wonderful inmate volunteers.
And prior to that, you were a spiritual advisor for the hospice that was involved, that was Hospice Slo County.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And in fact, Donna Kane was one of the people prior to your being executive director.
Right.
She was the one who actually had sat down with me and said, you know, we meet once a month and your expertise would really help. And so I agreed to do it. And I thought, well, this is an interesting job. But I have to tell you, on my first day of going in to work with the men, and I heard the clanging of the gates, and I saw the gun tower, and there's a part where you're almost isolated before the next gate opens. And it was kind of like, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
What is this? What are you asking of me? But I got through that first day and found that these men were so eager to change their way of thinking, their life. And I know Bill can tell you, Carson can tell you more about what this experience was for him as an individual. But I myself was very impressed with the openness and that sense of wanting to improve.
And Carson, like I said, there was no hospice care. There was no end-of-life care. That is what we know as hospice in the prison system. And most prisons don't have a hospice care. So talk a little bit about, you were incarcerated before being released for how many years?
45 and a half.
45 and a half years. Wow.
Okay. I took a plea bargain, and they told me that I'd do 19 years at the max if I kept my nose clean. It didn't work out that way.
Your nose wasn't that clean?
No, my nose was plenty clean. That other people came along and made other decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And unless you have it in writing and it's written into some kind of law, well, these are political concerns.
Yeah. Yeah.
That cost the state of California millions and millions of dollars when you multiply men like me by the tens of thousands that were held for long periods of time.
How old were you when you were initially incarcerated?
It was right after my 24th birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was paroled a few months before I turned 70.
Wow. Wow. So there's a whole lifetime
yeah.
that you were behind bars.
And during my incarceration, I never was written up for an act of violence, which is phenomenal. I'm not telling you I didn't have any acts of violence because you get attacked in prison.
Right.
But I was never the aggressor.
Yeah. Yeah. And talk about, you know, that when you moved from what prison to California Men's Colony?
I was in San Quentin during the, from 1980 to almost 86. It was one of the most violent periods in San Quentin's history.
Yes.
1 year I was there, there were 286 armed attacks with weapons on inmate against inmate or inmate against staff. I saw many men killed, friends killed, by their peers and by staff. And one a staff member I liked was murdered.
And in prison, Carson, the idea of compassion and kindness and mercy and love between, you know, love for humanity between a person who's incarcerated and another person. Is that the norm?
That is absolutely not the norm.
Yeah.
Especially among the young men.
Yeah.
Men in their 20s, teens, or 30s.
Yeah.
That is seen as weakness, mm-hmm. that you're a sucker, mm-hmm. that you can be taken advantage of, manipulated, attacked with impunity.
Yeah. So when you were in your late 50s, you got transferred to the men's colony.
No, I was going into my 30s when I did.
Went to men's colony?
The men's colony
okay.
in my 30s.
So when Lori and the hospice program came about, and they were talking about starting something, when did you get involved?
I got involved. I was 48, and I was seeing the rabbi, and he told me, it was Lon Moskowitz, he told me, by the way, I volunteered you for hospice work. You really need to do this. My first question was, what is hospice work?
Sure. Yeah.
Then he told me, and I went, uh-oh. I said to myself, uh-oh. I don't know if I'm strong enough for something like that.
Yeah.
But I had lost many friends in prison that through cancer, through liver disease, and I learned to take care of them, even men I didn't care for, because when they got sick, I could forgive everything else they might have done wrong in their lives or the lives they had currently been living. But when they became gravely ill, my heart opened it for them, and they would be taken away eventually, locked up into a cold, sterile room, and we never hear anything about them again.
Yeah.
Except maybe a few months later, oh, he's dead. Mm-hmm.
So until they were taken away to hospitals or to a unit to die, for the most part, people were being taken care of
by their friends, in
by
prison,
their cellies.
By their cellies, by yeah. the men that lived around them yeah. and protected.
Yeah.
It was just a code of respect for this sort of thing.
What's the biggest fear that you hear about for men who are aging in prison?
I think one of the biggest fears of no one caring, of dying in prison.
Yeah.
There is just that fear of never walking in a straight line again for as long as you want.
Yeah.
Never seeing your family in an environment that is not watched over and patrolled by security or custody,
yeah.
where you just cannot relax with loved ones.
So, Lori, when you got into the prison system as a spiritual advisor, you came from a volunteer hospice environment that was the first hospice here
right.
in San Luis Obispo County, a loving, kind, all doors open to everybody
right.
environment. Talk about the eye-opening?
Oh, well, one of the things that stands out to me as I, in the first training and the first lesson, we had the men introduce themselves, and one of the questions was, why are you doing this? Because you're not getting time off. Mm-hmm. There's really no external reward to this.
They weren't going to get brownie points for it. They weren't going to get paroled for it.
Right.
Right.
So each one went around and they said, I just want to make up for what I did. And then they would correct themselves and say, I know I can never make up for it, but I want my life to be different than what I've had. And most of these men were in their late 30s, 40s, 50s. Those were the first volunteers that I worked with. And what a contrast it was to any of the hospitals. I worked for a couple different agencies at times within the community. And there was that sense of, you know, being there with them and caring about them. And I must say that Richard Groves gave a good way of helping us build a framework, because I had studied under Richard Groves.
With Anamkara.
With the Anamkara Project, which he's up in Bend, Oregon, and he had been down here a few times, and talked about Anamkara, which is really a translation of the Gaelic of spiritual companion or spiritual friend. So I impressed that upon the volunteers, and they were like sponges. And one of the guys, though, came up to me during a break that we had, and he said, Lori, you're saying things that we really need to hear, we want to hear, and it's affecting him. It was affecting him. And he said, but do you know that when I leave this room, I'm a different man? I have to protect myself. And so it was kind of like a way of wearing two different masks. But gradually I saw the change in them. And when they would leave the program, when I would meet them in the hospital, they were this kind, caring guy. And other parts of the general population used to come to them at different times of the day and just need to talk to them, because they knew that he would listen and not make a judgment. I was just, the program was having an effect throughout the general population, even beyond the volunteer. It was wonderful. I love to see that.
Yeah, by the learning of the folks who were being trained as
they were living it. They were living out what was being taught.
Yeah.
Those commandments, we call them the Ten Commandments of the Anamkara, and which are really the character qualities of any volunteer or anyone who is caring for the dying. And they're ones we all strive for in our lives, no matter whether.
I'm going to take just a break, and I'm going to ask you to go through what those 10 are.
Okay.
I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. The voices you hear with me today are Lori Adolph and Carson Dean. They're co-authors of the book Storming Heaven, Comforting the Dying in Prison. We want to welcome you to our conversation today, and you can join us by bringing your comments or questions on air by calling us at 805-781-3875. And Lori, you were talking about the 10, kind of the essence of the learning that was part of the spiritual journey for these men at CMC in helping their peers through end of life. What are those?
Well, we call them the Ten Commandments of the Anamkara. Mm-hmm. And what they are is changing their character flaws into a positive quality that will support not only themselves, but the person that they are with. For example, in Chapter 1, we talk about being present. What does that really mean?
Yeah.
And we have a little blurb that goes under the title, to show up and be emotionally available. Don't promise the impossible. Let go of your own past and present concerns. So they're walking in there without a judgment and being present.
And how different is that for being in a prison environment where you always got to be aware of everything around you?
Oh, yeah. You're looking, right? You're looking behind yourself all the time.
And for you, Carson, what was that like when you finally felt like you had that skill?
It was a spiritual gift that I could set aside all my own baggage. And when you do 45 years in prison, it was a, kind of some of the hellhole situations I've experienced. It's hard to do that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to trust. It's hard to have your back to a door. It's hard to have anybody talking behind you without paying more attention to what's behind you than what's in front
of
you.
Yeah, got it.
But I was able to open up to a man that really needed me. It needed my full attention because as a disease progresses in a terminally ill person, their life narrows to just the immediate people in their circle. It's a shrinking circle.
Yeah.
As they maybe can't walk, and then maybe they can't get out of bed. And the dying isn't, it isn't like in movies where somebody gets sick and the next day they take a little nap.
Yeah.
Dying takes time for a lot of diseases, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of suffering mm-hmm. and being a witness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes an emotional strength that I didn't think that I had.
Yeah, you said that in the beginning. I don't think I can do this, right?
Yeah, I did not think I could do it.
Yeah.
But after my first client, which he was one of my most difficult, he was the poet. I talk about him in the book. And I knew him for a long time, and he specifically asked me to be on his team. And he had a form of like Lou Gehrig's disease where finally he only had one eye that could blink. And at the end, he couldn't even blink it. And he would try to put every emotion, everything that he was feeling into that stare. And I would be there with him, and I would talk to him, and I would wipe his face with a clean washcloth and comb his hair and just be there with him. And his passing, I learned so much from him and how he bore his suffering and what it meant to him. He had been a university professor. And as he lay dying, when he could still talk, he told me that he hadn't committed any crime. It had been an accident. Now, I'm nobody, but he needed me to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And innocent people do get convicted in prison. If you look on the media, you see him coming off death row sometimes. So here was a guy that didn't have that kind of case, but he did have a murder. And he was dying in that bed alone, except when we would come in.
And for clarity, the previous to this program, the men would be trying to stay in their cells as long as they could.
That's correct, yes.
So that they could be cared for by their peers and then would be removed when death was imminent. The teams that Carson talked about are teams that you helped form, Laurie.
Yes.
That would actually go into the hospital and would be with them bedside and would visit in the hospital. So it really did bring more of a hospice environment into the medical environment.
Right. It was more than just taking care of their body. It was really helping them prepare for the next step in their life journey. And the men themselves, if I could just take another step back, when they before the hospice program started, what they would do when men would become actively dying, they would put them in a room by themselves. There's a dormitory set up in the hospital, and plus there are rooms that have two people in them. Well, they would take the man and they would put him in a room by himself. And I remember one of the doctors saying to me, that's one of the hardest things. She would do what she could for him. And then she said there was one who she wasn't sure whether he was going to make it through the weekend. And when she came back on Monday, she went to inquire at the nurse's desk. And she said, "How is Mr. So-and-so?" And the nurse turned to the other and said, "Oh, is he dead yet?" And that really stuck in the doctor's mind.
Right.
And she was one who also wanted to see something more compassionate passing on. So,
yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, you did. So, yeah. And that takes me to another question. It sounds like in a carceral environment, there's really a conflict between punitive and
yes.
compassion. How do you marry those two? How do you combat those two? Because there are people who are dangerous people,
right.
who have done dangerous and bad things, who are incarcerated because of that. And, you know, can you argue that they still deserve compassion?
Oh, every one of them.
Yeah.
I remember Sandy Shelton, the medical social worker there, used to tell the nurses, keep in mind when you're treating the men, your men under your care, that they were once an innocent baby. And life has not treated them kindly. And yes, they made bad choices. But that doesn't mean that we have the right to ignore or mistreat them. It's a powerful statement. I always remember mm-hmm. Sandy saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, they were once a little boy. And that makes a big difference in how you approach them.
Yeah. When was there pushback for this program?
Oh, there was. Initially, there was. It took us a year to get with all the meetings and the implementation. And when I did say, you know, this is a community standard, they have every right to have this care. And then that kind of softened it. And the warden was behind it. He really wanted this kind of care for the men. He knew it would be good for them, their families, and everybody involved. One of the more difficult parts was with some of the custody. They didn't understand what was going on. We were being too kind to them.
Mm-hmm.
But then as time went on and they saw what we did, and custody would go in the middle of the night to wake up a volunteer and say, you're wanted at the hospital, and custody would walk them over to the hospital, and they would inquire. They would have a conversation with the volunteer, and it would often end with, well, thank you for all you're doing. It was just, that was another change
right.
that was occurring.
Did you experience that shift, Carson?
I did. There were many officers that were known for being pretty tough officers. But when they saw that we weren't there for anything but the person that was dying.
Yeah.
We weren't there to peddle drugs.
Right.
To barter, to manipulate, to do anything except to come in and offer emotional support to a man that was on that final journey of life, the last journey.
You and I had a conversation yesterday where we were talking about the prison environment, and that when you get incarcerated, there's this expectation from you as an inmate that everything you do is with the expectation of manipulation and bartering and trying to better yourself or trying to get something. That's a switch to trust.
It is an incredible switch.
And how did that feel for you?
Well, this program gave us a sense of self-worth.
Ah.
That we could make a positive contribution and be believe that we had an honest intent about it without a motive for personal gain.
Yeah.
This was something new for custody to realize that there were men like this incarcerated.
Did you know that you were capable of doing things authentic without personal gain?
Absolutely. But
before this
validated
this?
It. I knew that I was capable, but there was no venue to demonstrate it.
Ah.
And anytime you tried to do too much, your head stuck up and you got hammered down.
Yeah.
Because somewhere, someone has been in that position and done something wrong.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And that's what custody and security is based on. So the easiest answer to any question before it's even asked is no.
Yeah.
And I don't blame it, because saying yes can be a career ender.
Yeah.
It can be embarrassing. And custody, when officers feel like, hey, I'm never going to let myself be taken advantage of like that, or laughed about by their peers. Yeah, he's
took advantage of you.
Yeah, they got him. The inmates got him.
Yeah.
Because there is plenty of manipulation, mm-hmm. and drug deals and lying and violence.
If I could just add a little bit to that, one of the other things that changed so much after the program had been going on a while, and they were discovering that the men who were involved as volunteers were being released, and none of them were coming back. I was telling the assistant warden that one day, and he said, that is remarkable. Mm. We've never had a program where the recidivism is so low. He said, that's one reason for keeping it.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that and the numbers of people you train, too, which is really impressive. And Donna, I'm going to send it over to you for a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Next time on Latino USA, we take a deep dive into the first hours of Donald Trump's return to the White House and how our community is reacting. We also talk to Peruvian American author Marie Arana on her latest work, Latino Land, a book that helps us understand the past, present, and future of Latinos in this country. That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA. That's actually coming up next from 2 until 3 o'clock. Central Coast Voices continues with host Chris Kington Barker. That's a tongue twister.
It is. You're good at it, though.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome back. And my guests are Lori Adolph and Carson Dean, co-authors of the recently released book, Storming Heaven, Comforting the Dying in Prison. Lori, a spiritual advisor, helped create and directed a peer volunteer hospice program in the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. Carson, formerly incarcerated for a little over 45 years, spent the last decade or so in prison dedicated to that program. And their book is about their experiences during those years. We'd love to hear from you also, and you can call us at 805-781-3875 and bring your comments or questions into the discussion. And Lori, you were talking about the low recidivism of the men who were participating in this program. Overall, the 13 years, how many men did you train in this program?
I trained approximately 150 men.
Okay. And of those, how many are still incarcerated?
Three. Yes, and these were all lifers that I trained. They were men who, this was going to be their life in prison.
There were going to be life in prison.
Right.
Okay.
We're hoping for a parole, but there was no guarantee.
Right.
So to have that number, it was like, I mean, the warden was like, wow.
Yeah.
It was really pretty remarkable as I looked back at it. When I was doing it, it was like, well, these men are really, there's that inner transformation that I could see.
Talk about that inner transformation from the perspectives that you saw that you wrote about in the book. What are some that stand out for you?
Oh, well, I remember one of Carson's clients, and he relayed this story to me, where a man lay dying, and he looked up at Carson, and he was really actively dying, and he was able to speak. And he said, when will people stop thinking of me as a murderer? When will I ever be forgiven? And it was like, to carry that label and not being able to realize that you are a human with dignity, not being able to be validated, I should say. I think they recognized it within themselves. But to hear it from others. And so when we had our memorial services, we made sure that the goodness of whoever it was that died, it was, we expressed it. And the volunteers would often offer a brief eulogy at the memorial where they would talk about what it was like sitting with someone. And then we would try to match, like with music. Like I remember one gentleman, he loved the newspaper. He loved the Daily News. And the volunteers knew that they had to get a newspaper to him every day. And how much that meant to him. It normalized his life in a way. And we chose for the song for him, Some Good News by Anne Murray.
Yeah.
I think that's the name of it. And it was like, yeah, the guy said, oh, yeah, that's the song for him. And so that's what we were trying to do, to recognize that inner transformation. And it wasn't just with the person who died. A major part of it was with the volunteer and how that affected him. And for him to get up and talk about the last moments of someone dying when they were with them and how that affected them.
How did the peer volunteers have an impact on the men who were dying that staff would not have? Because they had some caring staff there. You described the social worker and you've talked about nurses. So it's not like they didn't have any staff, but how was it different?
It was a consistent relationship that was being built. One of the psychiatrists came to me one day and said, I want to talk to you for a minute. And I thought, oh, gosh, the guys have done something. No, not at all. He said, I want to commend the men that you are sending up here because this is the best time of my patient's life because the men do not ask anything of him. Hmm. They're not manipulating him. They are not requiring you give me something and I'll be here for you.
I'll be nice to
you. Yeah, I'll be nice to you. Mm-hmm. None of that. And he said it made a huge difference. But can you imagine? He was a fairly young man. I think he was in his 30s and was dying. And to never have a friend in his whole life. And that's what the difference that the team made. And they began to recognize what the impact was by their very presence. And so when the men would leave CMC, I would still hear from them. They'd write me or call me, and I would hear, oh, Lori, thank you for everything you taught me because I got home in time for my mother who was dying. Mm. And I was able to be with her, and I was able to help my family be with her.
So they brought those skills forward.
They did. Yeah. They did. And the men have often, frequently said what a difference that made for them to learn these, learn compassion by experiencing it and giving it.
In jail, Carson, you mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about your experience of sitting with someone that, you know, that it didn't matter who the person was. There are groups in prison. There's segregation in prison, or ways that people differentiate themselves. There's color barriers in prison. There's all kinds of ways that people get differentiated. How did that change for the people that were part of the teams, that didn't make a difference, or did it still make a difference?
The change was one of these beautiful things. Those of us that were Amakars trained by Lori, we didn't care what anybody's color was. We didn't care what their language was. We didn't care what crime they had committed, from the lowest ranking crime to a top of the pecking order. Under those circumstances, we did not care. We were there for them. Prison is brutal, a brutal pecking order based on numbers and strength and race and sometimes even creed. But in the hospice program, we were just there to be with another human being who is in dire need of a friend. And we developed consistent relationships. We would see them an hour at a time. Sometimes I could stay 2 hours. I would get to bring up a man's favorite music with me, the music that he listened to maybe when he was a teenager that he hadn't heard for 25 or 30 years. And I would sit there and we would play it and we both would enjoy it and just look at each other. We didn't have to talk all the time, just experiencing that moment. And I never cared for the pecking orders in prison, because they're terribly unfair. It seems to me that there is punishment enough when society banishes you and locks you in a box. And then there's a situation where the box gets shaken all the time until the men fight. And when the men quit fighting, they shake it some more by bringing people from other prisons that don't like the people in the particular prison you're in, and the box starts shaking again. And if you have a low-ranking crime, such as a sex crime, you are brutalized. You never know when someone's going to come up and just kick you in the face. You don't even know them. Mm. So when do those kind of punishments stop? I'm not pro-sex criminals, but I should tell you, most of them did not kill anybody. And the top of the pecking order is who? Murderers. Because the reason is they're in fear of us. You kill once, what's to stop you from doing it again? Or maybe you killed a bunch of people.
And did that stop within the group that you worked with?
Absolutely.
Did that talk go away?
That whole pecking order, that whole how you carried yourself, it all went away. And that's part of the spiritual transformation. That we are, it's a human-to-human relationship.
How is it for you being outside now? You've been outside how long?
I've been outside a little over 6 months.
Okay.
The first days were, I could only describe it if you were a child of the 60s, if you took LSD, because it was mind expanding.
Yeah.
I could just walk anywhere. I could just talk to anyone. I went to Morro Bay and looked at the rock, walked along the ocean, saw dogs, just dogs running around. I hadn't seen any free dogs. I saw children and mothers. These are all the things that a man does not have in prison. What he has is uniforms and hate groups and the constant paranoia and watchfulness, the vigilance.
So is this something that you think you've earned as a result of the work you've done?
That is not for me to decide. Mm. Okay. I hurt people terribly. I committed one terrible crime in my life. And from the moment it happened, I was sorry, but you can't undo it.
How much does what Carson's talking about reflect what the other men that you worked with?
Oh, it reflects it very well.
Yeah.
First of all, just for you to understand and your listeners to understand that the men, the volunteers, when they first came to us to want to volunteer, this was even before their training, we vetted them very, very thoroughly. We weren't just asking them to fill out an application and then we interviewed them, because as we know, they can say all kinds of things and then turn around and be quite different.
Yeah.
So we vetted them by even talking to their supervisors at work, their tier officer, where they lived, and then if there's somebody else who happens to know them, not necessarily another inmate, but, you know, another staff member who happens to see them and work with them at different times. We talked to them and took their suggestions very seriously. The letters to the tier, we would write letters to the tier officers. So it wasn't just an off-the-cuff remark.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very, very careful in who we brought up there to even start with. And yet, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned earlier, there were a few who just, it was just too much for them. They weren't quite in the place where they had that inner strength that was required to sit with somebody who's dying.
And you found that that also went along with the age
of
the person,
very
too.
Much so. We did try to have some people in their 20s. I think we just did it a couple times. And the men came to us and said, I just can't do this. I'm so sorry. And that was fine. And we understood. And we said, well, maybe when you're older, this may help. Mm-hmm. Because I think there is a wisdom to the ages. And the men will say it was something that would often happen to them around in their 30s, where they would look at themselves and go, I don't want to be this anymore.
Yeah.
I don't want to live this life anymore. I want to... living amends. I want to live a life of...
Even if I don't think I'm going to get out of prison.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So it was a pretty powerful experience to see all of them change. Because you have to know, I didn't realize how much an impact that this would have over the years. Because it went on for years. And it just continued to thrive. And I found out when they were in society, it continued to thrive.
And they continued to go out and find work that was meaningful work in a lot of cases, correct?
Yes. One of the men who, he was early on a volunteer, and he, with his brother, they started a program that cared for men who were being released from jail or prison who still needed medical care. And they gave him housing and a place to stay. Yes, there were certain rules they had to observe, but they gave them that one up a little bit because they were obviously physically in need too. And it's quite a change. It doesn't mean that everybody comes out just hunky-dory being in his program. But it made a difference in the society, and the hospitals now call him and ask, do we have somebody here? Do you have room to take this person? So that's a really good example of how they carried it on. But even in other work, that the men would be doing construction work, and they did it well. They were honest. They were reliable. They were caring. And even one of the guys that I met a few days ago at Costco, he was sharing with us what he was doing and how he, you know, and he says, it's made such a difference, Lori. You have no idea what a difference it made. It's like, well, that's great. I'm so glad. I'm so happy to see you so
and
happy.
And of the 150 that you trained, how many got reincarcerated, did you say?
Oh, who came back?
Who came back?
I think there were two.
Two.
And it was one of them was trying to leave the country because he wanted to visit his family. And he was on parole. And you just don't do that.
Yeah.
And then another one, I'm trying to even, I can't remember what it was, but how he broke parole and had to go back. But it wasn't like there was a turnover in.
We talked about how this changed Carson.
Yes.
How did it change you?
Oh my gosh. Just to even know the other side. You know, as they say, I've seen life from both sides now.
Right.
And I always had a sense of compassion for them, but now I understand much better, much more deeply, what the people go through that are in prison. And, you know, when they leave, it's like, I just want to take them all into my house and say, you're going to get through this just fine. I know you will. Just keep on doing what you're doing and keeping your heart open. You know, I know I can't do that, but it's something that it has opened me up a lot more.
Yeah. Is there a difference between being naive and being open-hearted about
it? Oh, yeah. Naive is, it's not just an innocence, but it's like an unrelated innocence where it's like, oh, you know, everybody's going to be happy after we get this done and da-da-da. And that doesn't work that way. And I think it's also contributes to, as I've gotten older and wiser, you know, the wise woman. And that is, that makes a difference in how we, our perspective. But having had that in-your-face experience of prison life, it has given me a deeper sense of compassion for them and all those that work there.
I'm Chris Kington Barker with you on Central Coast Voices, KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported station. If you recently joined us for today's show and want to hear the entire broadcast, it'll be available on our website at kcbx.org. Under the On Demand tab, click Central Coast Voices, and you'll find this show along with many other shows to choose from. The voices you hear with me today belong to Lori Adolf and Carson Dean, authors of the book Storming Heaven, Comforting the Dying in Prison. We have just under 15 minutes left in today's show and probably time for a call. If you want to call us at 805-781-3875. Lori, with the way things are now, it is not the norm still for hospices to be in prisons.
However, that is changing.
It is changing. Yes. And talk about that.
I understand that, well, what happened after I left, the program kind of died on the vine, to say. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have the care or the person who was really in there wanting to make it work. So it kind of petered away. But then Sacramento, eventually, there were a couple different places besides CMC that had hospice programs. And I'm not sure how they got through to Sacramento that this was such a good program. But Sacramento came out with saying, I think you should have hospice programs in all the prisons.
Yeah, there is an actual hospice, inpatient hospice at yes. California Men's Facility.
Yes. And there was one at, was it Vacaville, I think?
It's in Vacaville.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so that was a push.
Yeah.
So what is happening now at CMC is, and you're involved in it, mm-hmm. the revival of the program that we had. Of course, it's not the same thing. I was bringing different experiences and everything. Right. But it is a very life-changing experience for all mm-hmm. of us. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the fact that I come back into the memorials and to see those open faces in front of me and the men that are so sincere. And I know that they bring this pain. You know, you look at the prison and talk about grief. Everybody is grieving in prison. Everybody. They've lost freedom. They've lost family. They've lost friends. So there's that grief that permeates the whole place. And when they come to the memorials, they're able to set down their burden in a way and to just be part of it. And one of the men had told me, I always tell it what I call a Lori story at the memorial. And it's one of, you know, inspiration and hope that I would find someplace or hear about. And he said, you know, Lori, when you start your Lori story, I just sit back and close my eyes and pretend I'm in another place. And it's like, oh, gosh, what can I say? But it's that kind of thing that now I hope will be revived in this new
During your time, how often were people compassionately released from prison when they had a terminal illness?
Honestly, I don't remember. I mean, not anyone that I
It's not very common at all.
Did you
often have family visit the folks that you were seeing?
The way it was set up was a family could come and visit when someone was dying. If they were able to get down to the visiting room, they could visit their family. But it wasn't easily allowed up into the hospital. So that was a really... so. And also the men could not leave, even with custody with them. They couldn't go to a funeral. They couldn't go to their mother's funeral,
right,
or father's or anything. And just another added note, when the mother died, that was the most heartbreaking thing for any of the men, because oftentimes the mom was there, would send the birthday card, would call them, or they would call their mom on the phone and hear words of encouragement. And that meant so much to them. And I almost always knew when they would come in and they would just be so choked up they couldn't get it out, that their mom had died. And then we would talk it through and say, you could remember your mom at the memorial. And if there's a favorite song or music or thing that she liked, you could talk about that. And that meant a lot to them. It lifted that grief a little bit.
The stories that you've written about in the book are your stories about what took place and
yes,
how you see. Is there one or that really sticks out for you?
Oh, gosh, there were so many that made an impact on me. And I'm just trying to think of, I've related a few of them to you right now.
I'll go over.
Yeah, ask Carson.
Is there one that really sticks out for you that?
Well, there was one. His name was Charlie Bruin.
Oh,
and
yes.
I was at San Quentin with him when we in 1980. And after a year or two, you know, we went through a riot together. Because why did we in the riot? We went to breakfast. It's either eat or, you know, starve. So I lost track. He got into trouble there. And then 20 years later, he's here at the California Men's Colony. And 10 years after that, he was terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I shaved him. He had a beard like what's those animals? Porcupine.
Yeah.
He had a beard like a porcupine. He needed to shave 3 times a day. Okay, so I never shaved anybody myself. So there I am trying to shave him so he can go to a church service. I'm going to take him in the wheelchair, and he wanted a clean shave. I worked on his face for about 10 or 15 minutes. And he's giving me all kinds of help. He's giving me directions. He's looking in the mirror, and I pull my cheek this way, do this, do that. And I get him all shaved. That's just a memory that I will never forget.
Of trying to shave the porcupine face.
Of trying to shave a porcupine. And he was in good humor about it. And my regret with him is that I myself contracted cancer, and I had viral pneumonia. And as Charlie lay dying, I went into the hospital and couldn't be part of his last team.
Oh.
I was in the room next to him with viral pneumonia.
Oh, gee. So you couldn't get close to him.
And so there I am, really, really sick in this room. And he's within feet of me, and I couldn't see him as he took his final breaths for that day. And I will never forget that. I felt like I had let him down, but I know he understood.
Were some of your peers there with him?
They were absolutely
perfect
with him, and they came and told me.
Perfect.
And we had also set up a team for Carson Well, he was so ill, even though he wasn't, we didn't think he was dying. But I would always visit the people in the hospital every week. And I walked in on Carson, took one look at him, and he was the first volunteer that had ever been so very, very ill. I looked at him and said, "Would you excuse me? I'll be right back." And I went out and dried my eyes because I could barely look at him without going, "I think he might be dying." And to lose somebody
that was one of your own.
Oh, yeah. It was so difficult.
Yeah.
But he pulled through, and look at him now.
Yeah.
Big strapping guy.
Well, I'd like to comment about Lori. One of the things that worked for all of us, if to know Lori is to see this light in her. She has kind of a glow. And this glow is of trust and spiritual generosity that all of us who made it through that program and who made it out, if Lori calls, we call back.
Yeah.
If Lori needs something, it's, when can I, you know, I can't get there today. Can I come tomorrow? She has that kind of hold on those of us because she trusted us when no one else did in the world.
And she opened her heart, and I can see that. And I want to thank my guests for today's show, Lori Adolph and Carson Dean, authors of the book Storming Heaven, Comforting the Dying in Prison. It's available on Amazon. Next week, please join Mario Espinoza Kulik when he talks with guests about another topic of interest for you on the Central Coast. Lori, your website real quick.
Actually, I'd like people to text me. Right now, the website is in process.
Hurry.
So it's LoriAdolph@gmail.com.
Okay. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for being a CBX, KCBX listener, and for joining us on Central Coast Voices.